Hi everybody, welcome to today's episode of No Killing Goblins, where we talk a lot about the Wandering Inn. I'm your host, Oshi, and I'm here with...
Dragoness!
And
I got the intro right. Oh, System Glitch, we have to introduce you before you speak.
Or he can introduce himself.
Okay, we have a guest, System Glitch. Yep. Yay!
This is the most excited that I've been for a guest since we had Andy on.
That is true, because System Glitch is the composer and like musician who created all of the music that we use on this podcast and at the intro and the extra, and he did tons of other musical pieces that have to do with The Wandering Inn, and I've been really excited to get him on and to talk about him and talk about how he ended up here. I forgot to mention that we will also be talking about all that stuff. This episode's going to be a little long, isn't it?
That's fine. I mean, you get me talking about the Red Fangs and I'm tempted to wax a little poetic, especially because we'll be talking about when they get introduced, but talking to System Glitch is probably going to be more interesting.
Definitely. I mean, who wants to listen to us?
I mean, I don't remember too much about, you know, like the early story, so I'll have to have your guys help me a little bit. In that sense, but I'm like, if you want to ask stuff about music and or anything, then
we're gonna do. We're gonna ask stuff about music.
Right.
What I really want to do is have you like. Oh, okay. We'll get into it. We'll get into my desires for a musical episode. Why do I say I just have to give up. I call chapters episodes. Get over it, guys. In my head. So. Again, welcome. We're gonna chat all about it. But before we get started, there, what have you been up to, Dragna, since the last time we did?
I mean, considering we went from Saturday till Sunday, I've mostly just I stayed up all night playing Xenonauts, watching the Capcom Cup, and now I'm watching right now VCT EMEA, but a bunch of different VCT stuff is going on. So
esports has become too common in. Like the world, there's just like a whole, like it's just too much, and yeah. It's actually made me want to play video games less.
Well, it
like
it, so you were just playing League before this, and I've been listening
yes,
to.
Yes, but God's... I'm playing ARAMS. God damn it, it's
I've
not the
League.
Same.
I'm done with League. I'm never going back. I still watch the LCS sometimes, though. But no,
anyway,
oh,
what do you think about
because...
Gods? Like the song Gods, I think it's for the championship.
The one for the leagues?
Yeah.
I honestly, okay. This is going to get me attacked by anyone who is a fan of League. But first, I did not watch all of Arcane. I only watched like an episode and a half of Arcane.
Okay, that's absolutely
and most, and wow. Most of the music that comes out of League of Legends, I don't listen to. Because it tends to be very
like,
repetitive.
Aggressive.
No, just repetitive.
Well, it's meant
like,
to be.
It's literally like it's a fight song. It's like one of those fucking what do you call them? Like the songs that you always hear when people singing when you go to like a football game or something. They're always repeating the same chants over. That's all it is.
Yeah.
And sometimes it can be... I mean, the compositions can be wonderful. I liked the music intro that they did for Kindred. Did you hear that one?
I don't think so.
You should listen to that one. Yeah, Kindred. There's a, like... They did a full musical composition for Kindred. Some of those are really, really good. But I'm not a big fan of, like, the League... the sports league kind of songs. I love the compositions they do for when they introduce Champion, because they put a lot of thought into like the musical cues and stuff like that.
Wasn't Enemy like the introduction to what's her face again? One of the characters, I think it was Jinx, right? Jinx, yeah. Was basically Enemy was just like Jinx's thing, basically.
Yeah, it was like a whole music video. It was a pretty fucking good one too.
Yeah.
I think it's the login music. That's what it is. They laugh, they scream, that one. It's something. And then there's like a specific composition for Kindred. Wait, did someone just come in?
We appear to have. Hold on, let me find the. I have too many Discords.
No, oh, no. You're good.
We have achieved Kylora. He just surprised me, is all. Yep, we have achieved our producer, everybody.
To anybody who's listening to this, Kylora refuses to get a mic, so email her, message her until she fucking gets a mic.
Jesus Christ, oh, she knows.
It's funny.
But no, I've always liked the League music, especially the stuff they pull out for Worlds. I mean, yeah, mm-hmm. It's repetitive, but I don't know. I really like techno. I like dance music. I like house music. I like fucking the dubstep. It's just all good. It's all my style. The
dubstep.
Actually, the fight between Echo and Jinx was like had some pretty gnarly music. Mm-hmm. The rap section as well.
I like those. Like I said, whenever they do like a story-centric or a champion-centric thing, they can do some wonderful pieces, and they can be, like, orchestral, and can be multi-layered and all those things, but I'm never gonna be a fan of just, like, flat-out shit, like, music there. I watched this video. What made me really appreciate the Kindred, the Eternal Hunter stuff, is I watched this video for Marco Meatball, who is, like, a former opera singer, turned a social media and YouTube person, and he does a lot of videos like putting up his appreciation for video game music, and I learned a lot about like how like the depth of like I always knew there was a lot of musical like a lot went into like video game music, and I'm gonna be one of those people who are gonna admit that I kind of mute World of Warcraft so I can actually play the game sometimes because there's too many musical cues, but the music is amazing. Like I remember, the thing that always triggers me to like remember that video game music is wonderful is have you guys ever played Final Fantasy VI?
Yes,
I've played any of the games, but I've listened to soundtracks. So
they in Final Fantasy VI, the composer for Final Fantasy VI literally wrote, I think it was a full opera or an operetta using the limited like musical skill. Like he created an opera within the game, and it was a full opera. Like it is insane. And he did a full like 4-part opera with movements, with everything, and it was all done in the kind of 8-bit music style, and it's so like insane.
Yeah,
and I remember playing it, like I remember playing it for the first time and being like, what is this? Why is this good? What?
Yeah. Like, Six went hard. I actually still like Dancing Mad as its big boss music more than... But if you want to talk about, like, people who go hard with every video game, we got to talk about Guilty Gear, where every game comes out with its own full rock album.
Mm.
Guilty Gear? Does that sound familiar?
Genshin's
fighting game, but yeah. The individual character pieces, especially for this most recent one, it's basically a fully produced album where every song is just a character song, and they're all incredibly like good and a bunch of different styles, and it's just one of those things where it's like it's one thing to make like one of the best fighting game franchises out there, it's another to also decide you want to produce a rock album to go with it every game.
I think I've seen that from a video, like a video like basically gathering all the best music for video games, and I think that was one of them.
Before we dive further, maybe we should have System Glitch talk a little bit about who he is, because I feel a little awkward because we know who System Glitch is, but I don't know if everyone who's listening is going to. So, System Glitch, why don't you introduce yourself, like, a little bit about what you do, how you do your, like, music, and what brought you to The Wandering Inn? Why'd you start creating music for The Wandering Inn? What made you, like, start reading it and all that stuff? All
right, so, like, The Wandering Inn is, I think it's my first story that I've actually read, like... Like my brother got me into reading.
How old are
suggested
you?
Suggested me a few. I'm currently 22, but I read when The Wandering Inn like a few years after it started coming out, or maybe like as it was starting coming or as it was coming out. I'm not sure. But I got into that, and then like after like the first two volumes, I was like in parallel. I was also like doing like production on and off. Like music production, and I've learned piano, so that those two things hand in hand, and I was like, okay, I can use this. I can make some cool music for like different things that I liked in the story, and I ended up sending that to Pirate, and they like really liked it, and it just happened to be like one of the first fan works for the Wandering Inn. So that's cool.
I'm gonna tell you guys right now. We all know Pirate loves System Glitch. Like,
yeah,
it's just they talk. Yeah, the unofficial soundtrack, I think, for the main theme for The Wandering Inn is what we use for a lot of stuff. It's wonderful. I, of course, am a snobby pleb who wants like a vocal component to all of this, but System Glitch's like orchestral music composition is so wonderful. I would love to have like a actual song behind it all, but
I kind of prefer it without lyrics myself. I like the way that you can hear the character through just the music itself. But I don't know.
My musical background is like basically video game anime soundtracks and a little bit of like, you know, stuff that people listen to nowadays, but not too much. I don't like I personally don't listen to much music with vocals, so maybe that's the
that has probably a lot of influence on it, right? Like,
yeah.
you have to have some like experience with it, but it's a whole different world. We had a conversation before where I was showing him like my weird obsession.
Fascinating
with
conversation. What's that?
I don't know if it was fascinating. I think I embarrassed myself. It's like one of those moments where I'm like showing my weird heart. I grew up. Of course, I am from New York City. I grew up in New York, and one person once described it as like, you realize you live in a city, and not everybody has like a Broadway theater to go to. Like they can't get cheap seats at like the fucking public theater and watch Hamilton being made. That doesn't happen. And it's just it's one of those things that just I know about. Even if you're fully like disinterested in it, you understand that it exists. You can't miss the theater kids dancing and prancing out of Manhattan or biking into the city because they need to save $5 on their fucking subway ride or whatever the fuck it is. You just can't miss it. It's just like baked into the city. That doesn't exist everywhere. And the reason I'm mentioning all of this is because I have this picture in my head of, we talked about this. I had this picture in my head of doing like particular moments of like epic moments in The Wandering Inn where I thought like there should be a song behind this. There should be some kind of Sondheim music behind this. And I was still showing him all that stuff. I felt so weird for doing it because I have no real experience.
I've mentioned it to Oshi as well, but I've compiled like a list of basically events in the story in docs form, and like it's public, so people can add to it as well. Basically, I will be making more stuff soon-ish, maybe. I don't know. I want to make like a fully fledged thing for the Wandering Inn, and eventually like have it basically cover the entire story. But for now, I have the list which of things that are like events that are like super super nice or super would go very very well with some kind of theme behind them. So there's that. If anyone wants to add it, if anyone wants to add like an event or something, that is not. Or
yeah, either. I would. Go ahead.
I'll have to read through that, and actually, we can stick a link to that in like the doodly doo thing as well for this, because I'm kind of curious to see what's on there now.
Yeah, I can do it too.
Yeah, please. Kylera will does all the posts, and I'm sure she'd be happy to put it in there. And also all your socials and links, and of course, I was talking like we were talking a little bit before this. This server where the TWI talks happens, where we do our recordings for this. It's boosted, it has all this stuff for, like, audio events and things, and nobody does anything except for the book club stuff. Because, I mean, they fully did a song recording, and I'm like, why didn't they, like,
actually, use our server? I remember requesting, like, better audio quality in the One Dragon, like, voice chat.
Yeah, because I wanted to do
some music stuff there.
Yeah, don't do it. Do it here. Like, Pirate doesn't, like, pay attention to this. We made a space. What am I saying?
The stage, yeah.
Yeah, in an ideal world, we could get this to be the center of a lot of fan projects. I've even, like, floated the idea a couple times of occasionally doing a live recording for something like this. But I think it's just a matter of trying to get more people aware of the TWI Talk server and that we can do more on it than just the talks.
Yeah, and there's always the whole, like, Patreon versus not Patreon bullshit, which we have to deal with. It's so much. Anyway, that's all shitty stuff we don't need to talk about. So, the System Glitch is a cool composer who does video game music and has no idea who Sondheim is. He's also not American, just in case anybody needs to know. That's probably also contributes a little bit to it.
I mean, some, but I mean, this is just a weird Sondheim. Most people will know his musicals because they have heard of Cats, but they've never heard of Sondheim. Because actually,
Sondheim did not do Cats. Did he do Cats?
Did he not do Cats? Who am I thinking of then?
Who are you thinking of who did Cats?
Lloyd Webber. Okay, I got Andrew Lloyd Webber and Sondheim mixed up. Okay.
He did, like, he did Cinderella? I forgot that. He did Cinderella, too. Hilarious talking, guys.
I just completely reversed them in my mind. I'm thinking, yeah, Webber did West Side Story and Sondheim did Cats, right? Like, fucking... had them.
No, that's the one you're thinking of.
Yeah, I just mentally completely reversed all of their stuff. And I mean, yeah, most people might, I guess, have heard of West Side Story. I know Sweeney Todd was huge.
No, wait, West Side Story wasn't Sondheim either. What?
He did the lyrics.
He did the lyrics for West Side Story? Oh, yes, you're right. He did do that was the Broadway production. He didn't do the movie, did he?
The Broadway production came first.
Yeah, I know. That's what I'm saying. Like, that's why I don't know about it, because I know I always prefer the movie.
But, like, people will have heard of his stuff just because he has gotten so many movie adaptations. But actually knowing who Sondheim is feels weirdly niche.
And yet it isn't, because it's such a... Okay, let's not talk about Sondheim. This is not a musical theater. This is not a musical. Like, fucking Kylera just spoke up about Sondheim. So I think more people know than you think, or me. But great composers are the, like, the backbone of stuff. And, like, I realized talking to System Glitch, one of the things that's, I heard this when I was, like, younger. I heard older people talk to me about, like, preserving the great compositions of the past and talking about composers and not losing things. And I'm now of an age where I can say that to System Glitch.
Mm-hmm.
Please.
That's how it felt when you described all that stuff to me.
Yeah, like, it's so weird that I'm in the reverse position. But genuinely, like, these are the things that are foundational to the music that you're listening to today. Like, all the video game music that gets developed is based off of compositional influences from, like, the 90s and the 80s and the 70s and stuff. Those are the things that I got to listen to that made me, like, inspired me to do things, even though I'm not no longer musically inclined. Thank God I don't sing. My voice is terrible.
Pirate always like writes about how they would love to be able to like be good at music.
Yes. Like, everybody wants to be. The truth is, anyone can learn some kind of musical stuff. It truly is possible. And you can enjoy the music and love it. And that's the part that I always, like, hang on to. I can enjoy music, and I don't have to be, like, super skilled at it. Music is not just something that's for the experts. It's the same thing with, like, football or something. You can... Anyone can sing, even if it's not well, like... That's what fucking what is karaoke is for?
Yeah, karaoke and long showers.
Yeah. I'm gonna bring it back to the lyrical thing. So I have always wished that those folks who are like who know something about musical composition would like get together and like help maybe convince Pirate to do a musical episode, like a musical thing for The Wandering Inn.
Like a chapter? Or like an actual musical?
Yeah, thing? Like a chapter. Like the way they did it for the scientists and the doctors and stuff, but it's for a musical. Like, how would Pirate, like, imagine them writing something like, oh my god, I don't know, something about the car or something, and it's less about, like, big things happening is more about how a song is written or something like that. I'm like probably 10 people will be interested in it, but I would love that. And you guys like write music for it and there's like a song at it and it's just, it will be a collaborative effort and I'm sure it would take months to do. And I don't know.
Oh, actually that reminded me, like there is this alternate ending to Attack on Titan because people didn't like the actual ending. So there's this website. There's a website called the AOT No Requiem, something like that.
What the fuck?
Yeah, yeah. And then like once you read the chapter, it also like comes with the background music installed. Like basically, you start a chapter and it's like section has its own theme.
Yeah.
First off, what did they not like about the ending of Attack on Titan?
It was controversial. I loved it, but people lost their mind on the internet, and it's such a weird.
It was memed to death, basically.
Yeah. I don't even want to get into it. But, no. Like, on the Webtoon app, there's a lot of stories where, for a chapter or a set of chapters, there will be music that plays when you start reading it. And usually it syncs up decently well to, like, a not like too rushed reading pace, but I feel like sometimes with that stuff you run the risk of hitting a point where the music is hitting its notes at just the entire wrong moment in the chapter mm-hmm. you're reading.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's very tricky to make something work like that for basically any way that you would read it. Actually, I remember Pirate did that for the clown chapter, right? The first clown chapter.
Yes, they did. They tried to create the... I think Pirate tried to play with the medium more, and this is one of the other things where I wish they had like someone they could work with on a regular basis for collaborative stuff. But they tried to create like the creepy clown laugh, mm-hmm. and they tried to set it up so that the laugh would slowly build over time, and then you would hear it. So it wasn't just reading it, you were also creating like an atmospheric effect from the laugh. A lot of people were like surprised by it, did not like it. They thought it was too much.
I resampled that, by the way, in the clown track.
Did you?
It was okay, a very, very, so very good like source for me.
Yeah, I wonder who the original creator of that like laugh was, because that did deserve a prize all on its own. It was creepy. But yeah, I think what I really enjoy about the times Pirate like stretches out of doing just written work is that they like playing with like music and art and visual aspects of it. And they like playing with the idea that the chapter doesn't just have to be a written chapter. It can be something visual. It can be something like different. It's not just, it's a multimedia experience. Ugh, I've been trying to avoid saying those words, but it's a multimedia experience because it sounds like I'm fucking like, what is it?
Very corporate. Weird.
Yes, yeah. Not just corporate, but I have this picture of a teacher in, like, or a teacher's assistant or aide or something giving a lesson to a bunch of teachers about how to create a multimedia experience in your classroom. Just, I don't know what the fuck I'm saying. But what I'm trying to point out is that you can create, and it gives this opportunity for collaboration between, like, a variety of people. And it's not just Pirate doing this. It's this wonderful piece. And that's why I kept talking about the musical episode. It would be really hard to do, but it would be like Pirate could use music in their work. They could write the script for something, and the script for the chapter would lay out exactly how the chapter would work. They'd write it out, and then musicians would come in and create music based on it and incorporate the music into the written chapter, just like we do in musicals, literal musicals on Broadway. This is how it's done. You create, the book is written, the script is written, and then like costumers and folks come in and create the visual aspect of it. So there'd be art, and there's this joy in that kind of creative space. And I would love to experience that, even if it's tangentially, by like helping it happen, whatever, you know? But that's the little tiny bit of theater kid in me that's still left from high school.
Yeah, I'm also like, after the history lesson about that, I'm also got interested in that. So it might happen, you know. You never know.
Never. Okay. The only time anything I want happens is when I go out there and beg people to jump to go do it. And I don't have the living energy to do it anymore. I need to get through this year before I even think about any of this, of the rest of this stuff. Creative folks, if you want to do stuff, do stuff. Don't make me come out there and poke you until you go do stuff.
Plus one for me.
Okay. We drifted off the main topic, the reason we're here. We're supposed to be talking to the Wandering Inn. We're supposed to be talking about System Glitch, but wait. What was the first musical piece that you did for The Wandering Inn?
It was Ryoka's theme.
The Ryoka's theme? You wrote... So, for anyone curious, if you look on System Glitch's YouTube or their SoundCloud, I think...
Look, I was a teenager. There. I liked Ryoka's edginess, so, you know, that's how...
Oh, my God!
That's how it
was. Oh, my God. I'm gonna just say it right now. Like, this is the youth of the world. This is why Ryoka was like an asshole, because to appeal to System Glitch in his 17th.
Like talking with the people from the Wandering Inn who are like, you know, adults, and they hate Ryoka because she's a edgy character.
No, I hate Ryoka because Ryoka reminds me too much of me when I was Ryoka's age.
100%. It's nice to have a youthful person here, because we oldies have very different like filters and experiences when it comes to like reading The Wandering Inn, right, Dragonus?
We are old and curmudgeonly, yes.
Yeah,
I'm very much an anomaly among the people who read The Wandering Inn.
I don't think so. There's a lot of young people, they just don't do anything creative, and I'm like sitting there going like, aren't you the generation that's supposed to be, like, really good with TikTok and all that bullshit? Where's your...
Thank God I don't use TikTok. Although I do catch myself using YouTube Shorts.
But that's where all the music is... That's where all the music is made now, isn't it?
That's where all the music is, copied, basically, into.
Well, that's true.
But yeah, like trends, I was... like, trends are basically where TikTok does its best to propagate them.
I guess. I genuinely don't understand how it works in the like a deeper sense. Like, nobody makes money off TikTok except for like the people who already have money. So what the fuck is the point of like putting yourself out there that much on TikTok?
If you were like not getting to think about, you know, advertising yourself, then you would also think about making a TikTok page. Because that's what do people use these days.
Yeah. I mean, okay, I talked about this with, like, before. Dragonus, have you ever heard of this? There's this guy named Olive, okay, I have to talk about this. His name is Olive Song, at Olive Songs 11, that's one word, that's TikTok. I have to talk about this, because I said I would. So this guy, I think Kylera, you have to check him out. Please, God damn it, you have to check him out. So he did this music challenge on TikTok where he writes. He's a composer, musical theater nerd, but he does like many, many different styles. And he's been doing one song a day since the new year. And one of the songs he did was about Groundhog Day. And I need you to listen to this and recognize, I don't care if we have dead space for 2 minutes, you guys need to listen to this. I need you to listen carefully to this.
Yeah, I'm looking at it now. I'm trying to find specifically the Groundhog Day.
Oh, one. I don't want you to listen. I want you to listen to the duet.
Oh, sure,
hold on.
As a part of the history lesson?
Yeah, I see a couple of these that look like they might be duets, and I'm not fucking fluent enough in TikTok to work out which one
you need. Elise Myers, which like few people will know. I'm posting it to the various people. Here's the one for Kylera. I don't know if she's even still there, but listen to that. Listen. Experience it. The moment when it makes you both laugh and all the things. And that's not even the best one. There's a triptych with a guy who wears a top hat. That's even better than this. He has Mandy Patinkin's voice. Oh, the premise for this is the famous groundhog from the town drinks a sip of elixir to stay alive. Magic elixir to stay alive forever. So he can always be the groundhog for every spring. Groundhog, and he refuses to share it with his wife, Phyllis.
It looks like it's very popular. Almost half a million likes.
I like 5 million views, 10 million views at this point. But yeah, but who cares? That, none of that matters to me.
That was cute.
How dare you? It's not just cute.
I mean, I liked it. It was like good harmony. It felt like it could just actually be a real musical. And I found myself momentarily invested in its plot, which, you know, is funny for a 2 minute long TikTok.
I mean, it is, that's exactly what I want out of, this is so, like, devolving the kind of work, but that's what I want out of, like, music, just to get me invested for, like, a moment, and I wanted that, like, that's how I ended up loving The Wandering Inn, because I got invested for a moment, and Pirate does that so well with, like, written work, and I wanted music, I want music
like this. Pirate is fucking amazing at doing that.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, that. Now,
investing people.
Yeah, getting people invested. Good moments. Now, speaking of getting invested, let's talk about today's topic. The thing that got everybody invested, goblins. Goblins in book 6 of The Wandering Inn, The General of Israel. And we get to talk about all the things that happened to the goblins in this chapter, in this book, and all the things that will happen to them. The sadness and the happiness. And the what's the, God damn it. I was about to try and quote a musical, and I can't remember the exact thing. What's the thing from the chorus line? The one that the girl sings at the end when she's dancing in front of the mirror? God damn it, what is it?
I'm completely blank on it.
Never mind, we'll just move on. I'm not a good musical theater kid, apparently. So, plot overview of this is like... Okay, do we have to do a plot overview? We don't have to do a plot overview. We can go topic by topic if you guys are okay with that.
Yeah, I mean, so there's three sort of concurrently running goblin plots just through this story to talk about. Rags, Garen and Taremberag, and the Goblin Lord Rice.
Right, and then there's also, like, the outside looking in kind of view with Zell and Magnolia and what they're doing to try to stop the Goblin Lord, who is, by the way, is not named until the end of this book, but Rice is, like, the name he carries in the end is just, like, Jesus Christ, Pirate, what kind of, like, epic shit are you doing here? We'll get to that.
Tragedy we'll get around.
We'll get to that. But I think the first couple of chapters that, that deal with the what's happening with the Goblin Lord is 4.32G, and in it Pirate did write poetry, and the poetry was written by Pyrite, which I found beautiful. Like, Did you read that poem? Like, I'd forgotten the poem even existed until Kyrella put it in the notes.
Yeah, it's one of those things that I think is easy to forget across the story, is that Pyrite was fucking the man.
The goat.
The best.
It's the fucking goat.
Of all like, time.
God damn it.
He's the guys, eater
we need
goat.
More nuance. We need more nuance to your bullshit. Like, we can't just have you, like, sucking his dick off. Like, come on.
I'm sorry. Pyrite is just fucking cool, and there's no getting around it. And you're right. I had forgotten that he was also a poet on top of being an eloquent badass. Fucking
wasn't
minor.
He also, like, a fan of eating soap or something?
He ate everything. Anything and everything yeah. He could eat because it was better than starving.
Yeah, that's a... good part of his character.
It was, I think the chapter was kind of very slice of lifey, which was typical of things, but Pyrite's written aspect, the way he wrote, I think the line that kind of caught me, this is what I mean by this should be turned into music, guys, or somebody should say, we are not monsters yet, but we do not forget. We are lost, outcasts all. Like, I caught him too late, his sigh, a shudder, last goodbye. Like, these are God damn it. The lyrics are so... like, sorry, not the lyrics. What am I saying? The lines in the poetry are so, like, very obvious, but you don't really understand the context of them for, like, volumes and volumes.
Much like Rice not having a name, despite, you know, being literally at the point where he's lived long enough to raise himself up to being a goblin lord... this mm-hmm. poem has a deep underlying hopelessness to it, that to die and be murdered as a goblin is just the same as the wind blowing. It's inevitable and it has no reason. And we kind of get that at this point, but we also really don't. Not the way that it is going to be continued to be elaborated upon as we start to see in the Liskor section goblins in a place where they don't feel that impending threat of death over them and just how warped they are as a people.
Like, it's... God, I think in the note that Pyrite wrote for the chapter, Kyler highlights this. Pyrite have a note. An interesting chapter, is that code for bad? ? I thought I had to write at least one chapter from Pyrite's perspective. I can't believe they only wrote one chapter from Pyrite's perspective. If they'd written more, this is me saying anything. If they had written more from Pyrite's perspective, I wouldn't have like been so bored with the goblins as much as I was. There were only a few like goblin chapters. I'm gonna take the position right now, just so people know. Goblins are like the fifth on the level of what I care about the Wandering Inn for. Y'all can hate me, but that's like the fifth on my character list.
Why
Antinium beat them by a lot.
Why would I bother hating you for that? You're allowed to just be wrong in peace.
But back to Pyrite Abba's note. I thought I had to write at least one chapter from Pyrite's perspective. Perhaps only one, though. He's a deeper character and a good way to bring us back to goblins. After all, it's been a long time since we've seen them. And that's what that's a good highlight, is that in this book, we haven't actually like gone back to the goblins in a very long time. By the time you come to this, it's been like, I think, 10, 20, 30 chapters since the last goblin chapter.
Give or take, because we know that when, I think it was Rags leaving the mountain, and then I think we got a little bit in the way of updates from there. But yeah, this is sort of bringing this thread back in, because the goblins are going to be the core tentpole of the whole arc going through to the end of book 5 from here. And
Well, volume 5, not book 5. We're on book 6. Get it right.
Yeah, volume 5, book 6. Fuck words.
Okay, stop. Just to clarify, we are on book 6, which is part of volume 4 on the website, and what's going to happen is the next 3 books will cover volume 5, which is going to be a huge deal, because volume 5 is when Pyrite ups the stakes. I'm going to highlight a comment from someone, a Necroros, on this chapter. said, so it seems based on the smells were like colors to Pyrite line, that Pyrite has a form of synesthesia. And can I just take the opportunity to say that this is one of the things I love about the characterization in the story. Pirate Abra never, or almost never, flat out tells us that a character has a particular condition or neurodivergence. Rather, she shows us the symptoms, and often subtly but repeatedly, then lets us draw our own conclusions. I didn't even notice this.
I didn't notice this either.
Did you guys notice?
I remember actually reading that comment and going, oh, that's nifty, and then moving on and forgetting about it. Because
like I,
there's just so much when you're...
A perceptive reader.
Well, yeah, like, there's so much in this story that's going on, and I love the way that it can... it's so dense, and there's so much value in reading and reading and rereading.
We're already at 41 minutes long episode, so we did a lot of rambling. But I'm not rushing through this because I really do want to talk about, like, Laken a lot before we, he's the first on our list to talk about. And I want to talk about what happens with Laken and how he develops as a character in this book. And also just what he's doing with the Emperor chapters. Like, the creation of the Tinkerers and the fact that he basically says that someone has been telling him about all the stuff that he knows that makes him, like, very Emperor-like. The fact that he picks up, riding around on his Moss Bear. I don't know why that brings up some kind of imagery for me.
It brings up an Aladdin visual to me of, like, Aladdin riding on an elephant.
I was thinking about, like, Hindu Swamis riding up on, like, or, like, Buddhist monks who rode upon, like, spirit beasts and just walked like that.
Well, yeah, Aladdin was the Avatar. From those as reference, yeah.
Yeah. I think that was, like, pretty cool. And just all of the careful development as he establishes, like, the Black Sky Riders and the ultimate person who named... who suggested the name for the bear that Laken rides? Guess who it was? The Sandman.
Sandman?
Yeah, literally. The reader comment that Pirate picked out to name, I think to name, because Pirate solicited in the chapters a name for the bear. There was some dude named The Sandman says, if Laken wants a German name for his bear, why not Bismarck?
Ooh. Well, I do hope the Sandman is still around and can continue to pat themselves on the back for getting to recommend easily the best name option.
Honestly, yeah. As weirdly warlike as it was, Bismarck is actually a really good name for a bear.
Yeah.
Bismarck the bear? Who wouldn't love
Bismarck
that?
Bismarck makes a lot of sense. And most of the other alternatives that make sense, like, just when you think about it, are all tanks. And all of those were fucking driven around by Nazis, mostly. And
I mean, Bismarck wasn't exactly a nice guy, but sure.
Bismarck was the same as everybody else in his era when it came to realpolitik. He was just better at it. Like, as somebody to name something after, he's no better or worse than anyone else alive at that time. Unlike, say, naming it fucking Panzer or something. That could be a problem. Especially with all the fucking other associations Laken has.
What did you say, System Glitch? What?
Basically, Pirate needs to hire this guy.
I think the names would be better. The names would be better than what Pirate comes up with, let's be real.
I'm convinced that Pirate just drops stuff on a keyboard and then adds in vowels in order till it becomes pronounceable.
Antinium name.
Well, no, that just they don't even add the vowels at that point.
Okay, if you like, I'm sure Pirate just wanted, like, a species that they can just, like, you know, slam a desk and get a name.
Roll.
Because that, like, there's, like, enough species that they would have to think about the names and, like, the style of the name, which has to, like, correspond to the species. But, well, like, Antinium is just a freebie, basically.
I think we can say that Laken's development in this, like, was pretty rapid. And everything was set up for him to, like, be pissed off at the goblins because they kept raiding him. I mean, he literally developed protection against raiders because of the goblins. And I wonder, this is something maybe looking back at it with the lens of someone from who's fully caught up with the series, how much Lakin's development was because of the goblins, because of the conflict, because of the mistakes he made and the choices he made and the good stuff and the bad stuff, and how he as a ruler has been formed by it. I wish we had more. Yes, Pirate has to focus on Eren and continue the story, but I really do wish we had more of a focus on Lincoln. It's been so many volumes, and it's such a stagnant place. Like,
I mean,
the Empire.
I think that especially for where we're at, for like people who are caught up with the story, we have gotten enough Lakin. I think this time period specifically of Lakin's formative experience post the Avalanche and all of that stuff, but pre his encounter next volume, which I also believe is going to be in the next book, or if not that one, the one after. There was, I think, a little bit something missing to help us sort of see where he's coming from. Because, yeah, he's been in a pressure cooker. His experience has been heavily warped. And on top of that, he ultimately has to rely on other people to be his eyes. And I think it's interesting that we have a lot of Earthers who are sympathetic to goblins, and a lot of times it comes down to the fact they can see them and see that they are people. But to Lakin, they have always just been this antagonistic concept constantly trying to murder him and everyone around him. Not helped by him...
I really liked Lakin's development.
Yeah, sorry, go on.
I'm saying that Lakin developed... I think, like... contrary to what Oshie just said, I think Lakin's, there was enough Lakin in this specific instance. Because the main focus was the goblins, but also, I think Pirate did a great job, making developing Lakin as a character. They gave him just enough time to, you know, to be a likable character versus what he was before that.
Yeah,
Lakin, I'm trying to find a transition into the next part. I'm sorry. So the other person who was formed a lot and changed a lot by the conflict with Lakin is Rags. So Rags is like rapid development away into like being in charge of the tribe, and her she's forced, like her forces attack a human village in retaliation for killing a local goblin tribe. And they the humans killed everyone, including the children, and they string up the bodies, and it's forces like Magnolia, who sends Bethel and Thomas and the Petal Knights to deal with them, and that whole complex occurrence where the Flooded Water Tribes is like hunted by the knights. Pyrite drowns one of them, Greybeard injures Thomas, and the Chevaliers and the humans are forced to retreat. All of that leaves its mark, right? Greybeard reveals himself as Grey Death of Blades. And like that entire sequence where she is forced to confront what it means to be a goblin in a whole different light. Not as like a child in a primitive, like lost group of goblins who are like struggling to even find food, but as the leader of a group struggling to survive in a world that's...
And the realization that...
Like,
sorry.
No, I just wanted to finish the sentence. Like, struggling to survive in a world that just actively will murder them, and there will not be any kind of mercy. There's no mercy to any of this.
Yeah. So, I mean...
I wanted to mention as well about goblins. Sorry.
Go ahead.
You want to say? A thought before, goblins use death as a reference point, basically. Bad death, horrible death. You know, they describe things via death, which is basically indicating as well, if it's not it wasn't indicated enough, what their status in the inverses.
Mm-hmm. Just how they think
like their language is so deeply embedded with the concept of like their existence is one of multiple deaths. Like
it's like the thing with Eskimos where they, you know, there's that. I actually don't even know if this is true or not, but like it's the thing where it's like they have oh so many different kinds of words for snow to describe all the different varieties of snow. But honestly, I don't think that what Rags learned here was that she was going to die and be murdered and that there would be no mercy. I think Rags was just forced to accept here that yes, she's young and talented and capable and has levels, and she's nowhere near enough, and fucking Greydath says it straight to her.
Mm.
When you initiated the training arc.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then she built the fort and like forced Bethel to like retreat rather than risk any of her knights.
And this is ultimately like just the question of what's going on with Bethel is, if it was not for her and her flights of fancy and her desire to preserve her knights' lives over dealing with the problem, she could have just pushed on, accepted knights were going to die, and crushed Rags right here.
Mm-hmm. It's the choices that people make. We won't get into why the significance of all like Bethel's choices. Maybe in a spoiler filled future episode.
Well,
but
it's going to come up again when her next.
Remember what I said about spoiler? Okay, you know what? I give up. Someone bleep that.
I wanted to ask, actually, I don't know if I'm not sure if this is a spoiler, so I'm just going to say it might be a spoiler. Was this part of the story where the.
That comes up next. That's basically where right after this, yeah.
Okay.
So, this all leads into like the storylines that are significant for the old like goblins in a bigger sense. Like we get to see the goblins in a larger sense outside of just the sort of, I don't want to say myopic, but like limited narrow view of Rags. We meet Garen. We meet Tremberag. We see how Tremberag like wipes out an entire like Lady Rye's mansion and her place, and Laken has to save her and Magnolia doesn't and all that stuff. We see like how the Goblin Lord's army marches north and doesn't even like stop at Liscor, actually goes past Liscor, and he's headed towards Tramperag's mountain, and all of the effects that are happening, and we get to go around with Greydeath as he checks in on all these goblins, because he's looking for something. Which I don't think he ever explicitly says what he's looking for.
No.
He says he doesn't find it.
And I love the way that it works as a framing device, because, you know, these characters have all been introduced a little here and there. Some of them, especially Rice, are more of a mystery than others. So having Greydeath show up, sort of surmise their characters, mock them to their faces about what he feels their failings are, and then leave is a great way of sort of squaring them all up relative to each other and reintroducing them after the goblins have been gone for a bit. It's just a really nifty plot device. Also, Greydeath is fucking great.
Yeah, super nifty.
There's more, like, there's so much stuff that happens in the, I don't know how else to describe it. There's like stuff that's revealed. There's even that moment where the Rose Knights, they find the fortress and how she, like, the bigger thing, like, this is what I mean by, like, the decision she makes to retreat is going to be something that's going to be significant because, of what happens. I really wanted to dig into, like, Pirate's notes and stuff. But I don't think we have the time for that one. I am going to move on, just because as much as I love the goblins, I want to bring in the bigger aspect of the goblin stuff, because Rice, Zell and Magnolia are the big players in this volume. Because the entire last arc of this book is about what happens to Zell Shivertail, Magnolia Reinhardt, and the Goblin Lord, the unnamed Goblin Lord, who gains a name at the end of this book, was named after the the child that Zell Shivertail would have had with Saris. What was his last name? Does anyone remember know what Saris' last name was?
Oh gosh, we have the Wikipedia.
I don't think we get a last name. But anyway, Saris, the once great general, the leader of all the Drakes, who was the lover of Zell Shivertail. Like, it's, there's so many like revelations happened in the last like 3-4 chapters, and this is also like, I think, one of the big sources of people being pissed at Magnolia and saying that she's weak and ineffective and incapable of doing stuff, which I have a whole like fuck you argument for that. I mean, but I don't,
she did get outmaneuvered by Tyrion and did not have the military forces. If she had been able to maneuver better and actually get a properly sized army, Zell would not have had to make a desperate play and expose himself to the assassination attempt. Yes, it's true. Difficult to know ahead of time that a level fucking spoiler arc fucking necromancer with a goon squad explicitly designed to murder your general is going to teleport in to murder your general, but you know, hindsight's 2020, I guess.
Part of it got spoiled for that by peeking at the volume 5 first chapter.
Oh,
that was the biggest mistake of my life.
Oh my god, that's so horrible, because like
literally the first line is like
no,
just what happened.
And it hits so hard.
The first line too. I'm beating myself up for 2 days for that.
It was without a doubt one of the most well constructed, because a lot happens here. It isn't just that Magnolia, here's the thing, I don't think Magnolia got outmaneuvered in the building of the army. I think Magnolia got outmaneuvered because her goal is and always was to find a way to bring peace with the Drakes, and any move she made to stop Tyrion from starting up a bigger conflict was going to require either her to do something tragically horrific, or she could desperately try to like use this as a situation to bring together the North and South and try to blunt his edge, and which is what she was trying to do. Like, she said a lot that she was trying to create a force and trying to convince like Nears to come here, and all this stuff. But I guess I'm not really refuting that she's weak. Let me say right out the why I don't think she got outmaneuvered. Her goal was always to bring peace. Her goal was to avoid using the heavy-handed Reinhardt, like murdering everybody was not a solution that she could use. If she was allowed to murder everybody, I'm pretty sure she would have already killed everybody involved in all this and been fine. But that's not what she's trying to do. And that's why I think, like, she got fucked over. And the biggest reason out of all of this isn't something that is the third player in all this. The fourth player in all this. Azkarush. Like, the assassination squad wasn't something that just came out of, like, if it was typical Goblin Lord versus Drakes versus, sorry, not typical Goblin, but like goblins versus Drakes versus humans, it would have played out pretty well. She would have gotten her army, Zell would have been in charge, all that stuff. Azkarush, however, spoiled the soup, yeah. Right?
Like I said, she had no way of knowing Azkarush was waiting in the wings with like a dedicated anti-kill Zell Shivertail goon squad.
She made... Like, he made someone to kill Zell.
Yeah,
like,
no, it was a purpose-built goon squad, right? There's no way she could have known that was going to happen. But at the end of the day, like, Tyrion did outmaneuver her. They both put up a levy, and he got the good soldiers, and he got most of the soldiers, and she didn't. Like,
but that was inevitable, right?
It's an understandable place for her to get outmaneuvered on, given relative military experience and other factors. But you can't say she didn't get outmaneuvered and he didn't get the soldiers and she did.
Well, the thing is, had she been able to... Had the assassination squad not been there, I think what she was banking on was Zell being able to turn...
Well,
a ragtag army into a real one, and that's what she wanted, because she didn't want a real army. She wanted
bullshit.
She wanted a cooperative force She wanted to, like, present the world with, hey, look, Zell Shivertail left the South and is leading a bunch of humans to stop a problem that's affecting all of the North and all of the South because it's goblins.
And that could have worked and just as well, if not better, if she had actually gotten competent soldiers right before a massive battle against an army that was outnumbering her. If she had gotten, like, the assassination squad would not matter if she had managed to get a properly sized army. And in see in character, she is mad about it. This was not part of some long game con plan she had.
I didn't think it was. I'm not saying it was. I'm saying that it's impossible to, like, say that her goals were not reached. Clearly, Zell's death was a complete disaster for her. Everything, like, went to shambles. But you have to recognize that what she was trying to do is very different from what, like, was happening here. She didn't need a super powerful army. She needed a show of cooperation. Magnolia Reinhardt works with Zell Shivertail to save the North kind of deal. While Tyrion leads all the great armies of the North to go fight some drakes, she saves the North from the Goblin Lord. That was the goal. That she fucked up? Yes. Definitely. But that was not... The point was never to, like, oppose Tyrion in directly. It was supposed to... Tyrion abandons the North to go fight drakes on a plane.
He was literally mustering his army to also go fight the Goblin Lord.
But the Goblin Lord's army was... Where was the Goblin Lord's army?
On its way north into human lands. Like, remember, he is still mustering it when she has the battle because Rice went to seek her out. Like, I feel like you are... misremembering some specific details and timings here. Her plan was always going to have been better and more useful if she had managed to get both more soldiers and some more competent soldiers. Like, when she tries to put out the levy, Tyrion gets them, she doesn't. He outmaneuvered her there. It really is that simple.
No, I'm not denying she got worse soldiers, but I'm saying that you're saying that there's some kind of maneuver going on here, but it's not about the soldier quality.
Yes, it is.
If your goal is not...
If you don't have quality soldiers, then you lose the fight and all of your other goals fall apart. She put out the levy, he put out the levy, she expected to get more and better recruits than she got for that army. She says so herself. Like, Tyrion got them, and she didn't.
What does that have to do with her goal of creating a cooperative moment?
If she loses the fight, or if she dies because the army loses the battle, then her cooperation doesn't mean shit. You can't cooperate in a loss.
But you're saying that but this is predicated on the idea that if Azkaresh wasn't there... she still would have lost.
No.
There is no
guarantee of victory, even with all the artifacts she had.
But that's what you're saying, though. That's what I'm trying to say, is that from her perspective, if we remove Azkaresh from this period,
from her very overconfident perspective.
Fine. If Azkaresh wasn't involved, if the assassination squad wasn't there, if Rice wasn't the Goblin Lord of Necromancy, let's say, even if he was the Goblin Lord of Necromancy, she could have pulled off, if not a victory, a stalemate because of Zell Shivertail.
She had to engage in a significantly riskier endeavor because she did not get the soldiers she expected to have. Tyrion got them instead.
Okay, I think we've exhausted this and probably bored System Glitch.
Sorry, System Glitch, we may have gotten into
it. Yeah, it's fine.
You can be the deciding vote if you want. Get on in here.
I'm good.
I think... like, what happened, what the sequence, the arc that built
up. If we're good, we're good, but let's just move on, then.
I'm trying to move on. Like, that's what I was trying to do. The sequence that built up to Zell's death and the entire scene. I literally talked about this with System Glitch before. I wanted that to be a full, like, torch song slash, like, what is it? Like, big musical moment. I thought that should be a musical moment. Like, having Zell speaking about his lost love, naming Rice, dying knowing that Azkaresh was still alive, killing Oom, all of those things were such fucking epic moments. And Azkaresh watching it all and, like, having the reaction he did and his kids being ripped apart. Like, he ripped a couple of them apart, let's be real. Literally. He would have won if not for, like, yeah. Well, like, this
it,
is,
it would have been a so stalemate, because he was as good as dead the moment he got touched, and at that point he can kill all of them and then he'll die.
Yeah, and it's just, I think that's one of those musical moments that should be, like, respected. It is pivotal what happens at the end of this, because it is both the end of Volume 4, the end of Book 6, and the end of what I think is, like, a moment of peace in the Wandering Inn. Like, it's a catalyst for so much shit that happens. And
stuff that happens after this. Jeez.
Yeah, yeah. And it reverberates for, like, entire volumes. It's not just the, like, the death of Zell affects everybody. Magnolia, Tyrion, from the big people to the small people.
Yeah, some of the long-term effects. Yeah, some of the long-term effects of Zell's death and, like, who he was on this battlefield are felt all the way through and past the end of the most recent volume.
I remember seeing Ilvris as, like, a drunk side character, and now after that he just became one of the best, like, plot lines.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, Zell has that conversation with him about being drunk and about being so, like, lost in his grief that he's not able to, like, process things. And, like, Zell is a full adult. He has lost and loved and lived a life and been rejected and been all these things. And here is, he is such the, like, the mentor for such a long period of time. And I can't believe I missed the fact that he's gay. Like, well, I didn't miss it. I had suspicions, but I was like, no, Pirate doesn't. This is before I like, read enough of the volumes to understand the Pirates does this thing where they create, like, subtle lines that show off just how fucking deep it goes, but because they don't want to write about, like, certain things because they don't have the experience or they don't want to for whatever reason. Like, remember their conversation about the kid, like, Jesus Christ. It's amazing. It's amazing that this character existed. It's amazing that the character was allowed to be gay. But I want to address this. We have two queer people. We have two, one I don't know anything about, System Glitch's preferences. But Kylaris, did you guys ever suspect that Zell was maybe not completely straight? Or that there was something more there between Zell and Saris?
Personally, I thought that it was a possibility, but there were so many potential things going on with him, right? Because a lot of up until the very end here, probably the biggest hint we got was some of the uncomfortableness around when he was getting asked when he was going to have kids. And, you know, that's an awkward question, fucking no matter who you are, when fucking your family members start asking when the grandbabies come along. So that alone wasn't enough. But by the end of this and his death, yeah, I was reasonably certain.
Yeah, I never actually paid too much attention to that, but it's like rereading that and, like, noticing these things is very fascinating.
Yeah. It's a mark of a good twist that you can get so much new context from how he acts in these volumes.
I loved everything about, like, the subtlety and the drama and the... This is what I love about this kind of write. Pirate pretends that I'm a dramatic person. Look at what they fucking did for Zell's death sequences and all of the, like, the... They even made time for Azkaresh to talk to Zell. Like, it happens.
That's how it goes.
Yeah. the amount
any,
of like
any epic scene, any epic death scene has to include some kind of dialogue.
Yeah. And let's be real, that's probably one of the big unexpected benefits of high level people being so virtually impossible to kill, is they get plenty of time to talk because they just take a long time to die.
And just having that chapter where like we get introduced about a bunch of stuff, and Ilvers, there is that intimation that Ilvers talks about. I can't believe I didn't pick up on it. Ilvers talks about how Zell might be a hero, but he's been like, he's not well liked by the other cities because he opposes war with the humans, and he's been a target of politicians for years. It's like every signal that this is someone who's like, I don't know. There's something in my head, like. I should have listened to the warning. Sometimes it happens. My gaydar sometimes does not go off.
It's well disguised, because there are a lot of, well, I was going to use the phrase legitimate, but I don't. So he does oppose war with the humans. He does tend to back the little guy and work with like the consortiums against the walled cities. There are a lot of, I guess, valid from their perspective reasons for some of these people to not like him that have nothing to do with him being potentially queer, until you realize he is, and then suddenly all of that recontextualizes, and those are the excuses. But until we get that look behind the curtain, it's kind of like Schrödinger's
cat.
You want to say Schrödinger's queerness or something? I almost said something way worse. But where it could be that, it could not be that. It could be a lot of things. Mm-hmm. It's difficult to tell.
Okay. We've talked. The two of us have talked a lot. System glitch. Do you have anything you want to contribute to the, like, anything you want to highlight or talk about from these chapters?
Or just wandering that was, like, in general?
Yeah.
I mean, besides the fact that I got spoiled, but let's see. Like, I think a lot of the stuff that I really liked was happened after this, like with the what happened with Tyrion and, like, you know, Tremorag, Rags, and all that, you know, like getting together. And
yeah, book volume 5 was the biggie. Like, it's the one that a lot of people point to when they go, like, this is when I fell in, like, not fell in love, but like, this is the big moment for the Wandering Inn. Volume 5, the three books, Reigns of Lyskor, Blood of Lyskor, and Tears of Lyskor are the three things that sort of solidify the core group for the Wandering Inn for a very, very long time. The core storylines, how it works, and truly like establishes goblins and establishes the point of view for Pirate. And I think it's like the watershed when things turn around. And this book is the precursor to that, and the ending of this book, I think, is the first time where I felt like this isn't just some, like, simple story. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it definitely, like, even after, like, I got spoiled, I read the chapters, and I still really, really enjoy them, and, like, it is just crazy how Pirate can do all these clashing plot lines together into this one huge mess, and then somehow like resolve it afterwards. So the goblins, like Zell dying, Askarage just showing up. So basically everything we talked about, I don't really have anything to contribute besides the fact that I really, really liked it.
No, but I mean, liking it is the point. Like, it, I mean, we're all fans. There are things that we love and don't love. Okay, I don't want to end on a sour note, but I do want to address this for folks. There was, Pirate did suffer some blowback for the Zell reveal from both the right and the left, so to speak. Not everybody was comfortable with Zell being queer, and then there was also a lot of, like, implication from certain quarters that this was a bury your great gays trope, where we only got to know he's gay for a little bit and then he dies. Like,
I mean, it's not even that. It's he dies and then we find out he was gay.
Yeah, that's true. Well, no, we find out literally in the moment of his, just before he
Then, it's just strongly implied.
I think that's true.
But I'll also say, honestly, I think that people who are uncomfortable or dislike the idea of there being a queer character can get the fuck over it. And people who think that having a complex, interesting, and nuanced character have layers that are revealed after his tragic, before his time, fucking book-defining death, want to say that the person doing it is fucking throwing up flags of homophobia. No, stop.
We'll move on from that point. I think I more wanted to focus on the critique that putting this revelation at the end, after his death, not contextualizing it, not allowing us to see any, like, clues or like, see him being queer in some way was sort of a cop-out. That was one of the critiques that I remember from the period of time that there was even, like, I remember one person specifically saying this. They didn't love the fact that it felt a little like Dumbledoring, like from J.K. Rowling's Dumbledoring of him. And I was very insulted by that because I felt like this is a good character. We didn't need to see that we didn't need to be confirmed that he was good. It's great. It gives us all these layers that we can explore beyond his death and see what that means about Drake society and Drake, all these things. But we didn't need to see him being... You didn't need to see him being gay. That, like... And at the same time, some part of me... And I want to admit this out loud. Some part of me did wish we could have seen him, like, have a beer and maybe make out with a hot guy. Like, some part of me is like... I mean, I know he was a Drake. I know not everybody loves the whole reptilian draconic thing. But he's still... Like, he's a ridiculously muscled, hot general guy. I would have loved to have seen him, like, maybe have a moment, or at least talk about, or have memories of Saris, or something like that, or go see his statue, and, like, we get a tiny hint or something. The subtlety of, like, showing romantic feeling is not something Pirate was, like, super good at the time. They got much better over time. I think there's a chapter that comes up in Volume 8, where they did an excellent job with a pair of characters. Or Volume 9? Sorry, Volume 9, yes. Where they did a really great job with a pair of Drake characters that come up very, very late in. Where they showed the nuance of romance without it ever being explicitly said, and allowed both characters to exist in a more, like, great way. Again, that just shows Pirate evolved as a writer, yeah. Right?
So I'll have to, something to look after.
Yeah, definitely.
I don't even think there's anything to complain about here for, like, the subtlety or lack thereof. I think it was as obvious as it was meant to be, and as it needed to be. And I don't get the comparison with the Dumbledore thing. I also think that the Dumbledore thing is, like, a 2 on a scale of Rowling being a shitbag, and even before she turned out to be wildly insane, I thought it was a weird complaint to begin with. But
I mean, let's
it's just
what
it's just he's well written. He's a good character. It works.
What did you say?
No need to go.
I've only heard about Dumbledore and the Rowling stuff, like, secondhand. I haven't actually, like, gotten.
You have not. Okay, yes, he's too young for Harry Potter. How is he too young for Harry Potter?
I know. I'm talking about, like, the whole drama thing. I know Harry Potter. I've read.
Okay. Yeah. Good. No, I mean,
if there was any key fundamental mistake, it's that she also did not find some way to bring up the fact that he was gay at some point in the 7th book. All the hints were there. There were hints earlier, too, once you know what you're looking for. She just, you know, fucked it up because she actually wasn't that good of a writer.
I think I just realized I didn't turn my fan off the whole time, so whoever's editing this, I'm very sorry. And on that note, I think we can wrap it up here. We've talked quite a bit about everything that we needed to. I hope you guys had a lot of fun. Say goodbye, Dragonus and System Glitch.
Goodbye.
And for everybody out there who is, like, a musician or a creative, go talk to System Glitch. Compose something for us. Give me some music. Make me a musical. Matchmaker, make me a match. God damn it.
I mean, I don't need a musical, but if you do wind up forming a Wandering Inn themed band, I will absolutely listen to all of that music, and you should call yourselves the Red Fangs. Goodbye.
The Red Fangs, yo. Like a rock band.
Yes.
Really, oh yeah.
People. With people having like, okay, we should have had like a Red Fang 5 rock band with Numb Tongue at the lead. Anyway, bye-bye everybody. Say bye.
Bye-bye. Peace out.
Listening to No Killing Goblins,
edited by System Glitch.
The music on No Killing Goblins was composed by System Glitch. They can be found at youtube.com/systemglitch. You can get in touch with us via our Twitter at No Killing Goblin, or email us at nokillinggoblins with an S at gmail.com.